This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in Your Health, the family dinner. About a decade ago, research started appearing on the family dinner, and the news was uniformly good. According to the scientists, children who ate with their families were less likely to drink, smoke, do drugs, struggle with asthma, get depressed, and have eating disorders. Today, NPR's Elise Spiegel reconsiders the reputed power of dinner and explores what the research really tells us.
In the last 6 or 7 years, a number of public figures have thrown caution to the winds and taken up the cause of the family dinner. The comedian George Lopez and the actress Jamie Lee Curtis have both recorded public service announcements. Then recently, another public figure lent a familiar name to the cause.
Hi, Mr. President. My parents believe that eating meals together will make our country strong. Is this something that you did when you were a kid?
I did eat with my family so long as my mother wasn't cooking.
It's not good making fun of your mother, even if you are president, but it is good to have dinner with your kids.
In this public service announcement, Barbara Bush goes on to explain that children who eat with their parents are less likely to end up with a drug, cigarette, or alcohol habit. Now, research has shown that children who eat with their parents are less likely to struggle with substance abuse. The question at issue is only this. Is it that dinner itself offers some magical protection, or is there something else at work? David Dickinson, a professor of education at Vanderbilt University, says this is an open question.
It's possible that some of these findings are occurring because the ability to organize a mealtime and come together may be just one indicator of a family that's reasonably intact and functional.
Now, Dickinson's done his own research on dinner. A number of years ago, he and some researchers from Harvard wanted to figure out why some kids learned to read early while others lagged behind. To do this, they decided to look at family routines. The researchers recorded mealtimes, but they also looked at other things, how often parents read to their children, played with their children. And according to Dickinson, the group came to the study with some very firm expectations.
We naturally expected that the data on book reading would be most powerful because so much research is focused on book reading.
But, says Dickinson, the headline the study produced was very different.
What we found was that our data on the quality of conversations in mealtimes was a much stronger predictor of how later development would go for children's language and literacy development.
So the moral seemed to be eat dinner, read early. But as Dickinson will tell you, a deeper look at the study might suggest a slightly different conclusion. Turned out the content of dinner was important. That is, the kids who did well didn't just eat dinner with families. They ate dinner with families that maintained complex conversation, rich with explanation, storytelling, and more.
When a new word was used, like suppose reptile, and the parent who would stop and say, oh, you know, like a snake, or say something that would give a child a little definition for what that word meant. Those kinds of interactions were really powerful.
Dinner provided an opportunity for children to be exposed to these language behaviors on a regular basis, but dinner in a limited verbal environment apparently didn't have the same benefits. And this kind of thing is true in a variety of the studies on dinner. For example, Barbara Feese of Syracuse University studies how family interactions affect asthma in children. She does this by looking at family routines, rituals around filling prescriptions, weekend activities, religious observance. And like Dickinson, she found that one of these routines stood out.
We keep coming back to dinner time. It does have some powerful effects, both for physical and mental health.
Specifically, Feese found that asthmatic children who ate dinner with their families were less likely to end up in emergency rooms. But again, it turns out that those families had to engage in some very specific behaviors at dinner.
The three factors that we find that predict the physical and the mental health outcomes are how the meal is accomplished, that is, are roles assigned, something as simple as, setting the table and knowing that there's a beginning and an end to the meal. The second thing is a genuine concern about each other's daily activities.
Finally, asthmatic children had to be shown a certain kind of empathy in order to benefit. Now, that's a fairly extensive set of behaviors, which raises this question. Can a dysfunctional family sit down to dinner and benefit?
If the meal is conducted in a way to support healthy development,
So in other words, what you're saying is the only way that a dysfunctional family can get the benefits from sitting down to dinner is by being a functional family.
That they can be prepared to deal with some of the things that happen at the table. That's true.
But not everyone sees it this way.
Even in families where family relationships are difficult, family meals can still be found to predict better outcomes.
This is Dr. Diane Newmark-Stainer, a professor at the University of Minnesota who studies the relationship between dinner and eating disorders. For a most recent study, Newmark-Stainer gave an extensive questionnaire to kids in school.
We asked the adolescents questions such as, how much do you feel like you can talk to your mother or your father about problems? How much do you feel like your mother and father care about you?
And Newmark-Stainer says that even kids who didn't much trust their parents were less likely to develop an eating disorder when they sat down to dinner with them. But she admits that a questionnaire study like the one she conducted can't offer a definitive view of the role of dinner.
We need to do an experimental intervention where you have similar families, you randomize them into regular family meal groups and non-regular family meal groups, and you see what the outcome is.
That's precisely the kind of study that has never been done because it's a difficult study to arrange. And so in the meantime, researchers are left to speculate on the independent value of dinner. David Dickinson of Vanderbilt is skeptical that it is the meal alone.
I think it's very unlikely that it's simply having dinner. So if one could mandate that everybody sits down and eats dinner together, I don't think that's necessarily going to have the sort of beneficial effects that people observe.
So perhaps all the good news on dinner is premature. At this point, it's difficult to say. But as Dickinson points out, there's one solid certainty about dinner. It is one of the few times in modern life when families can sit down together, speak face to face, build relationships, monitor behavior. All things, he says, that simply can't hurt. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here's the headline from some of the news we're following here today at NPR News. Former governor of Massachusetts Mitt Romney withdrew his presidential nomination bid earlier today, speaking to the Conservative Political Action Conference here in Washington, D.C. Senator John McCain addressed that same conference later in the day. We'll hear some remarks from Senator McCain in a few minutes on this program, more later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. There's a story, maybe true, maybe not, of a challenge to Ernest Hemingway. Write a story in just 6 words. For sale, he wrote, baby shoes, never worn. A couple of years ago, the online magazine Smith adapted that challenge and asked readers to send the stories of their lives in just 6 words. Thousands have since arrived, some from famous people. Stephen Colbert wrote, well, I thought it was funny. Most from folks like you and me. I especially like Jancy Dunn's ABCs, MTV, SATs, THC, IRA, NPR. So tell us your life story in 6 words. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. I've posted my own 6-word memoir on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, and you're welcome to share yours there as well. Many of the best submissions to Smith Magazine have been collected in a new book called Not Quite What I Was Planning, 6-word memoirs by writers famous and obscure. Editors Rachel Ferschleiser and Larry Smith join us now from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Neil.
And I can't believe the passion and interest that this excited since we announced it, what, less than 40 minutes ago or so. We've gotten hundreds of emails, people sending in 6-word memoirs. What a great idea.
It's a passion we share with you. When we posted the idea on our site about a year and a half ago, Smith Magazine, we said, can you tell a life story in 6 words, like Hemingway did? He told fiction. We're a memoir site, a storytelling magazine. 15,000 people in 2 months came bursting through our doors. They had so much to say. They were funny. They were sad. We were blown away by what people were capable of. And frankly, it really reassured us about the power of personal storytelling.
And reassured people that in a world where people are prolix to the nth degree, that people can be terse.
Well, less is more. Brevity is the soul of it and the soul of wit. And you really, it boils down to life's essence. We, in the book, we have both famous folks and non-famous folks. Most of it are folks who've never been published anywhere. They're not going to write for The New Yorker. They're not going to have a best-selling memoir. And then other folks are very well known. Mario Batali, how many words have been written about Molto Mario? Amazing character. I love all those words about him. He sent in 7 life stories. The one we have in the book is brought it to a boil often.
And that's a great one. Yet, Rachel, a lot of these are, well, very, very personal, almost painful, some of them.
Yeah, we were really amazed. I think at first we thought people would try to be funny, they'd be clever, they'd be pithy. But people were so honest. People talked about how lonely they were, things they regretted. They really shared their sadness and fears, and it was really incredible.
Still brewing coffee for two. I'm not sure I got all the six words in there, but...
I still make coffee for
I
two.
I still make coffee for two. And yet, as you point out in the introduction to your book, you might have thought that reading it initially might have been a widower. It turns out?
He's about 28 or 29. He lives in San Francisco. He had just broken up with a girlfriend, and he was really upset. And he's a lot better now. But it's amazing what you don't necessarily know about people.
And some of these are about roads not taken, children not had, children who died.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were so generous, these contributors, sharing their personal stories. I've been in touch with almost all 800 of them, and they've sent me pictures. The guy who wrote about the dead children had sent us a photo of these two tiny headstones that was so heartbreaking, and he was just willing to share it with strangers because I think sharing your story really helps in a lot of ways.
Let's share some of the ones we've gotten in by email. This from Reverend Jim, abandoned, adopted, Catholic, police officer, family, transformed. Redemptive. A lot of the ones seem to be redemptive, too.
You see life themes. There's a lot of stories in this book, 832. But you do see some common things, religion, babies, children, regrets. It's interesting. We got a lot of actually a number about Mormons, you know, in the news today. About 5 minutes before we came on, I looked at the site because they keep coming in all the time. And Brian Duncan, we don't know Brian Duncan, he tells us, not Mormon, I'm microphone singer now.
Here's one we got, and Rye comes up a lot, too. From Joey in Tucson, Arizona. Musician for life. Fries with that?
Burgers and fries did seem to be a sub-theme. A six-word memoir in the book is, I make burgers and fries.
There's actually a fries section in the index.
A fries section in the index. Let's get Carol on the line. Carol's calling us from Fremont, California.
Hi.
Hi, Carol. What's your six-word memoir?
Left-handed lesbian Polish rocket scientist.
Wow.
That's a good one.
Carol's got a lot going on. It reminds me of one of my favorites. Boyfriend in bed, still a lesbian.
Carol, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Hector. Hector's with us from Arcata in California. Hector, you there?
Yeah, right here.
What's your six-word memoir?
Born poor, worked hard, died happy.
That's a good one, Hector. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Would you want that, Hector, on your headstone?
Yeah, that wouldn't be bad.
That's not so bad.
No.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. That summing up the life in a few pithy words, that's part of the aim of what you're going here for.
Well, some of the stories are quite universal. Life is circular, caring for parents. Almost anyone can relate to that. Other stories tell a very, very personal narrative story. After Harvard, had baby with crackhead. Now, most of us didn't go to Harvard. Most of us didn't have a baby with a crackhead. But we can understand what that woman went through. She had an amazing life experience. And in six words, we've gotten a whole story. Very personal.
Here's one of those circular ones. This is from David in Little Rock. Sleep, work, eat, rinse and repeat. Let's do, this is Matt. Matt with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, mine's good bad luck, bad good luck.
That's not too bad either. And again, might fit on the headstone.
Yeah, not too bad.
And that reminds us why the number six is just so magical. Something works about it. You have the symmetry of 3 and 3, and you have the 2, 2, 2, and for whatever reason, 5 isn't the word, and it's not 7. 6 words is the way to tell a short, short life story.
Whose was it that, and thanks very much for the call, Matt, whose was it that was on the 7th word he rested?
That's Stephen Dubner, the co-editor of Freakonomics. Co-author, sorry, we're co-editors.
Let's see if we can go now to, this is Brent. Brent with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi.
Hi, Brent.
Hi, my story would be, never loved, always rejected, good anyway.
Huh. Wow. And you know what I like so much about what Brenda said is that the first two words she said were my story. And as we see these six-word memoirs come in on our site and we collected the best, for, not so much the best, but a selection for the book, Each time I see a six-word memoir come on the site, a little, you know, bell goes off. My heart just races a beat because it just means so much that people are willing to be so intimate with perfect strangers. And to tell your story, as you know, there's all sorts of great storytelling avenues these days. To tell your story, I think, is the start of something, you know, bigger and better maybe in your own life.
Brenda, thanks very much.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. Let's talk with Brian. Brian's with us from Rehoboth, Delaware.
Hi.
You there, Brian?
Yeah, how you doing?
Very well, thanks. You're on the air. Go ahead. What's your six-word memoir?
Oh, gifted, anguished, medicated, phoenix, potential, exercised.
All right. Thanks very much for that. Here's an email we got from Roxanne. It says it needs to be done in a Germanic Heidi Klum accent, which I'm not going to try to approximate on the radio. Either you're in or you're out. Defending an America like a farmer would. That's from Major Walker, who's interested, wanted to send that in. My six words, writes Joe Neuse, I knew, don't know, might know. And there's a lot of them like that in this book, too.
Well, there's a lot of hope and optimism across the book. There's a whole range of emotions. It's a fun little book, you know. But on the other hand, you're flipping through it, and you go through a whole range of emotions, anguish, laughter, candor, intimacy. It's a very weird experience to go through the book and realize how close you feel to some of these folks.
Probably worried for nothing, I know. That from Alyssa in Tucson, Arizona. Indiana Jones in the female form from Jana in Napa, California. My beautiful wife is my life. That from Al. And there are certainly tributes and, of course, a lot of painful recollections of significant others in the book.
Absolutely. We have one from a young widower who sent me a picture of his beautiful bride. People are willing to share so much. But despite how sad some of it can be, most of all, the book is fun. People pass it around. People make them up for each other. You bring it to a dinner party and conversations just go crazy. I really think that the fun of it sort of overtakes the sadness, but I'm glad that it has both.
Libby writes us from Sacramento, California. As an avid knitter, I've been assured by my family that my six-word memoir will also be my epitaph. Just let me finish this row.
Well, I think we've all been there. There's a woman named Michelle who's in the book, and she says, we were our own Springer episode. Who hasn't felt that at some point in their life, if not, frankly, each day?
Here's one from Lisa in Tallahassee, 51, and still in school.
There were a lot about higher ed.
Yes. Melissa writes us, as a mother, paraeducator, and horticulturalist, I painted, I nurtured, they grew. So that's people looking almost for adages sometimes.
There's some of that. There's some of life philosophies that come out. One of my favorite is a very light one, but it says so much about this woman. A sundress can cure life's woes. A sundress has cured many of my woes, and I wasn't even wearing the sundress.
This one from Mike in Charlotte, North Carolina. Fork in road, took left turn. And words of wisdom, how can I? That from Steve Griffin in Tampa, Florida. And inevitably, Larry Smith and Rachel Ferschleiser, you're going to be asked for your own six-word memoirs.
Absolutely. Mine is bespectacled, besneakered, read and ran around. I sort of invented the word besneakered, but I really think it speaks to me.
It's going to be in the OED next edition.
Thanks.
And yours, Larry?
A little tricky for the radio, but you can come up with whatever image you like. Big hair, big heart, big hurry.
Rachel Ferschleiser and Larry Smith are co-editors of the book that's called Not Quite What I Was Planning, Six-Word Memoirs by Writers Famous and Obscure. They're collected from Smith Magazine, which is an online publication. And is this, you think that you're going to be soliciting these for as long as you can imagine?
As long as they keep coming, we'll keep taking them in. It's amazing to go on the site. We feature some of our favorites every day. And if you can't get enough, you can read all of them as they come in. It's an overwhelming amount of wonderful life stories, six words at a time.
Thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Neil.
Larry Smith and Rachel Ferschleiser joined us from our bureau in New York. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. And we begin this morning with an update on a story we brought you last week about a meeting between the Army and the Department of Veterans Affairs at an Army base in upstate New York. NPR has obtained a document that flatly contradicts the Army Surgeon General's account of that meeting. Here's NPR's Ari Shapiro with the story.
When I visited Fort Drum in upstate New York last month, soldiers told me they felt betrayed by the groups that are supposed to help them. The Veterans Affairs Department used to help soldiers at Fort Drum Army Base with their military disability paperwork. That paperwork can determine whether veterans get health care and disability benefits. About a year ago, an Army team from Washington told the VA to stop offering that help. The Army wouldn't say who visited the base or why those visitors reined in the VA. The Army Surgeon General's spokeswoman, Cynthia Vaughn, even said it's fine for the VA to help soldiers with their Army paperwork.
There is no Army policy on outside help in reviewing and or assisting soldiers in rewriting their narratives during the 10-day period which they have to review them.
The day the story aired, the Army Surgeon General denied parts of it altogether. This is Republican Congressman John McHugh, who represents the Fort Drum area, speaking with North Country Public Radio last week.
The Surgeon General of the Army told me very flatly that it was not the Army that told the VA to stop this help.
Now NPR has obtained a four-page summary of the Army team's meeting with the VA, and it contradicts the Army Surgeon General. One of the VA officials from Fort Drum wrote the document the day after the meeting. It says Colonel Becky Baker of the Army Surgeon General's office told the VA to discontinue counseling soldiers on the appropriateness of Defense Department ratings because, in her words, there exists a conflict of interest. Baker referred an interview request to the Army Surgeon General's spokeswoman, who rejected NPR's requests for interviews with Baker and the Surgeon General. The document says before the Army team's visit, people from the Army Inspector General's office came to Fort Drum and told the VA it was providing a useful service to soldiers by reviewing their disability paperwork. According to the document, the second member of the Army team at Fort Drum last March was Dr. Alan Janisevich.
I was part of the team, and I was probably instrumental in the Surgeon General denying that the Army had instructed the VA as such.
Janisevich retired as Deputy Assistant Surgeon General for the Army in October. He says he has no memory of Baker telling the VA to stop helping soldiers with their military paperwork. But he also says his recollection of the meeting is spotty. It took place a year ago, and it was the last of 11 Army bases he reviewed.
I believe that document is more likely to represent a miscommunication of intent between what Colonel Baker was trying to get across and what the folks at, on the receiving end of that communication likely heard.
Janisevich says he's surprised that soldiers didn't complain about this earlier.
They're the first and the quickest to spot any inconsistencies, errors, or shortcomings and let us know about it.
But soldiers are also afraid of retaliation, which is why so few would talk with us for this story. This VA document says the primary purpose for the visit was to, quote, ensure that there are no other Walter Reed situations at other Army installations. That's a reference to the scandal at the Army Hospital in Washington. And the concern was apparently well-founded. Rosie Taylor recently retired as Fort Drum's disability program manager. At the meeting last March, she described soldiers at the base in conditions of squalor and neglect.
You know, you see soldiers crawling on their bellies to go to the bathroom, or soldiers that had surgery and couldn't go to chow because there was no way to get there.
The document says one soldier was bedridden for 3 days without a change of clothes or a meal. Taylor says nobody listened to her complaints until the Walter Reed scandal.
Every time I walked into a meeting before, it was like, oh my God, there goes $70,000. And after Walter Reed hit the fan, it was like I was getting phone calls. Rosie, we're doing over a building and we need your advice on access.
Taylor says the accessibility problems have generally been solved. She doesn't remember whether the Army told the VA to stop helping soldiers with their disability paperwork or not, but she will say this about Fort Drum's VA workers.
They stand on their heads for soldiers. They put their jobs on the line for soldiers. They don't care if they're not supposed to do something. If a soldier needs something done, they do it anyway.
New York Senator Hillary Clinton has already asked the Army to investigate the situation at Fort Drum. She called the allegations in last week's report deeply disturbing. Whether the situation at the Army base is a result of poor communication, poor memory, or something else altogether, the result is the same. For the last year, hundreds of disabled soldiers at Fort Drum have received less help with their disability paperwork than the veterans who came before them. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
You can read the document describing the Fort Drum meeting and hear Ari's original piece on the controversy at npr.org. The Grammy Awards are this Sunday, with nominees in more than 100 categories, including a new category, Best Zydeco or Cajun Music Album. This comes at a time when there's been a resurgence of interest in Cajun music by several young 20-something bands in Louisiana. One of them is the Pine Leaf Boys. They've been nominated for their second album, Blues de Musician. NPR's Jason Beaubien spoke with them in their hometown of Lafayette, Louisiana.
The Grant Street Dance Hall in Lafayette is an old brick building next to the railroad tracks. Its rough-hewn floorboards have been worn smooth by decades of dancers. The place can hold several hundred people, but on this Sunday night, as the Pine Leaf Boys tune up, there are only a few dozen patrons, mostly milling at the bar. But this is a loyal crowd that's come to dance, and as soon as Wilson Savoie pumps the first notes out of his accordion, couples race onto the dance floor. The audience is a mix of young men in baseball caps and senior citizens in plaid dress shirts. The Pine Leaf Boys range in age from 21 to 27, and like many young bands, they sort of fell together. Wilson Savoie says they formed in 2004 when he and guitarist Jean Bertrand rented a house in Lafayette.
We started playing music, me and him, and people started moving in with us.
And soon, four of the five band members were living under one roof.
Nobody would really help. The house was always a disgusting wreck, and there were just beer bottles and mold growing everywhere. And you'd open the fridge, and the night before, you'd leave all this great food for you to eat, and you'd open the next morning, and it'd all be totally gone, replaced with empty beer bottles and cans. And it was rather stressful, yet living like that.
While the house broke up at the end of last year, the band has stayed together, and over the last 3 years, put out two CDs. Accordionist Wilson Savoie comes from a family of musicians. His father, Mark, and his mother, Anne, are both well-known in the Cajun music world. While Wilson was exposed to the music as a kid, he didn't grow up speaking French. The Pine Leaf Boys sing exclusively in French, yet all of them learned it later in life. Wilson Savoie says a lot of young musicians from the area have been traveling to Quebec lately to attend French immersion classes.
This generation that we are part of in the mid-20s and early 20s are somewhat repairing what was almost a dying culture and a dying language from the generation before us.
Along with the Lost Bayou Ramblers, the Red Stick Ramblers, and several other local bands, the Pine Leaf Boys are part of a new wave of young Cajuns who are spicing up the music of their ancestors. Scott Ages is a former music editor at the Times-Picayune, who's now with the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation. He says Southwest Louisiana is experiencing the second wave of a Cajun revival.
The guys that grew up in the 70s, trying to create a resurgence in Cajun culture, Acadian pride, like Michael Doucette from Beausoleil and Zachary Richard, this is exactly what they were trying to, that they hoped one day that they would be able to see, that there would be this new cadre of young guys keeping it alive.
There are so many new, young Cajun bands that last year the Jazz and Heritage Foundation, which puts on the New Orleans Jazz Fest, launched a separate Louisiana Cajun Zydeco Festival. And Scott Ages says they had more bands than they could accommodate at the three-day event. The Cajuns, however, haven't always been popular. Themes of discrimination and hardship run through their music. Further along the bayou in Lake Charles, Mayor Randy Roach says over the last century, Cajun culture has been under threat from floods, hurricanes, poverty, and modernization. Despite all this, he says these descendants of dispossessed Acadians thrived here in the swampy lowlands of coastal Louisiana.
The Acadians were the people that nobody wanted, and they were exiled from Nova Scotia, and they were basically dismissed by every community along the eastern seaboard. And they went into the coastal region of Louisiana because that was the only place that they could go. It was the land that nobody wanted, and it was settled by the people that nobody wanted.
Backstage at the Grant Street Dance Hall in Lafayette, guitarist John Bertrand cautions that the Pine Leaf Boys are not trying to be saviors of Cajun culture or even trying to preserve traditional music. Bertrand says he doesn't wake up each day and try to be Cajun. This is the music he grew up around, and he says flatly it's the music he wants to play.
This just happens to be music that gets us excited, you know. We're preserving something, I guess, which, you know, we're really proud of. But it's not something we don't want it to have that taste like it's behind glass. Whoa.
Neither their recordings nor their live shows sound like the Pine Leaf Boys are behind glass. At the Grant Street Dance Hall, they mix traditional waltzes with blues numbers. You hear country riffs and even some rockabilly. On stage, Bertrand wears a cowboy hat and jet black Ray-Ban sunglasses. He and Savoie dance almost as passionately as the crowd. Waltzing couples whirl across the dance floor, and as if some strange magnetic force was at work, the dancers circulate counterclockwise past the stage. Jack Rowe, a retired real estate broker, has just stepped out of the club. He's 65 years old and a big fan of the young guys up on stage.
I like the Cajun music, but they play with a little more vim and vigor and vitality and draws a younger crowd also. And some of those women dance with more enthusiasm.
His eyes light up and a wide smile flashes across his face. Rowe says he'll catch this music whenever he gets the chance. The members of the band express a similar sentiment. If the Pine Leaf Boys weren't performing at the Grant Street Dance Hall, they say they'd probably be playing this same music over at Wilson's house, drinking all his beer, eating all his food, and dancing into the wee hours, as others have done down here for generations. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. The Pentagon's budget has hit a new milestone. Adjusted for inflation, it's the highest in more than 60 years. By the end of this year, the United States will spend $750 billion, that's trillion, on defense. So we ask NPR's Guy Raz to take a look at how some of that money is spent.
Say you bought $3,000 worth of Lockheed Martin stock on September 10th, 2001. Lockheed is the biggest defense contractor in America. Now, if you bought that stock, your $3,000 would be worth close to $10,000 today. It's not that Lockheed has a revolutionary business model, but the past few years have been very good for business. The company's biggest customer is the U.S. government, so Lockheed's success hinges on increases in defense spending, spending on things like its F-22 fighter jet. The F-22 is the most expensive fighter jet in history, more than $300 million a pop. It has no rival, and yet
it has finally, after 25 years of expensive development, reached what the Air Force calls full operational capability, meaning it's ready to go to war. We've got two wars going on, and it has not flown a single sortie in either war.
This is Winslow Wheeler, an analyst with the Center for Defense Information. He says the F-22 serves little purpose today. It was designed to fight the Soviets in air-to-air combat. And the F-22 program alone has cost taxpayers $60 billion, or about as much as the GDP of a country like Slovakia or Vietnam. But the F-22 is still very much alive. It's alive, says Christopher Hellman, an analyst at the Center for Arms Control, because of one thing: Congress.
Lockheed Martin very candidly will tell you on their website that they represent tens of thousands of employees in 45 of the 50 states. When you have that kind of political clout behind you, it's very easy to convince members of Congress that continuing a program like that is important to their constituencies.
And Lockheed, like many other defense contractors, has managed to successfully equate its products with America's national security.
Lockheed Martin. We begin with the things that matter. Freedom.
This is one of the company's corporate ads. Lockheed, like all the other major defense contractors, hands out campaign money to both Democrats and Republicans. President Bush is one of its biggest recipients, but so are two of the strongest opponents of the Iraq War in Congress. Democrats Jack Murtha, he's the chairman of the committee that doles out money to the Pentagon, and Ike Skelton, the congressman who oversees the military. Now, when Republicans control Congress, industry money trends their way. Now that Democrats control it, the trend has reversed.
No one ever lost an election by voting for more spending for the Pentagon, but you can easily lose one by being perceived as soft on defense.
Christopher Hellman notes that Lockheed's projects are just a part of what drives the defense budget. There's missile defense, new jet fighters, a new naval destroyer, Virginia-class submarines. The list goes on. And budget analysts estimate that these big-ticket items now make up almost half of the Pentagon's regular budget. According to Miriam Pemberton, a researcher with the Institute for Policy Studies, many of these programs
have no real value for any, you know, counterterrorism operations. You know, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban don't have any fighter jets and are never going to get any. So these big-ticket items drive the budget and become de facto our security priorities when they don't, in fact, enhance our security.
And defense spending, she says, is no longer a controversial issue on Capitol Hill. But it wasn't always that way.
Members of the Congress, I have the distinguished honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Just a few days after his inauguration in 1953, President Dwight Eisenhower, he was the first general to serve as president in the 20th century, stunned Congress by promoting deep cuts in defense spending.
To amass military power without regard to our economic capacity would be to defend ourselves against one kind of disaster by inviting another.
What Eisenhower said was true then. It's just that now it's 10 times more true.
And as Winslow Wheeler points out, today Congress usually adds more money to the Pentagon's budget requests. Wheeler was forced to step down from his job as a Republican staffer on the Senate Budget Committee in 2002 after he wrote an article blasting bloated defense spending. He explains that every year, members of Congress figure out which defense projects will benefit their own districts, and then they add it to the defense budget.
One of the misunderstandings about the PORC system is that people think it's stuffed down the unwilling throat of the Defense Department. That is not the case in 9 out of 10 cases. As a matter of fact, you won't get your PORC project added to a defense appropriations bill unless someone in the Pentagon does approve the project.
The United States now spends more on defense than every other country in the world combined. And the Pentagon's spending power alone makes it richer than Australia. And yet, over the past 7 years, despite massive funding increases, troops in Iraq and Afghanistan have faced equipment shortages and lack of proper armor. Here's Christopher Hellman again.
When we send our men and women off to war, we feel rightly that they be the best trained, best equipped, best supported military on the field. The irony, however, is that higher defense budgets don't necessarily mean that that will be the case.
We spend more today on defense than we have ever spent since the end of World War II in inflation-adjusted dollars. Our military forces are today smaller than they have ever been since the end of World War II. We are quite literally getting less for more.
Now, last year, researcher Miriam Pemberton took a hard look at the Pentagon's budget, and she wanted to answer a question.
It's important that we spend what we need to keep ourselves safe and secure. But the question is, you know, what kind of spending is going to do that best?
So Pemberton crunched the numbers, and she found that the Pentagon could still fund troops, equipment, maintenance, even modernization. And on top of that, put money into diplomacy, humanitarian aid, and other forms of preventative security, and still easily cut the budget by 10%. And the value of that 10% alone, well, it's still more than the combined annual wealth of Guatemala and Costa Rica. Guy Raz, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Biofuels like corn ethanol have been hailed as a climate-friendly source of energy.
But a new study says that burning those alternative fuels is actually twice as bad as burning gasoline from the standpoint of global warming. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, if the findings hold, they could force major changes in the rapidly growing biofuels industry.
At first blush, biofuels like corn ethanol and soybean diesel seem like they'd be great from the standpoint of global warming. The crops soak up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as they grow, and that balances out the carbon dioxide they produce when they're burned. But until now, nobody has fully analyzed all the ripple effects of this industry. And Tim Searchinger, a visiting scholar at Princeton University, says those effects turn out to be huge.
The simplest explanation is that when we divert our corn or soybeans to fuel, if people around the world are going to continue to eat the same amount that they're already eating, you have to replace that food somewhere else.
Searchinger and his colleagues looked globally to figure out where the new cropland is coming from as American farmers produce fuel crops where they used to grow food. The answer is that biofuel production here is driving agriculture to expand in other parts of the world.
That's done in significant part by burning down forest, plowing up grassland. That releases a great deal of carbon dioxide.
In fact, their study, published online today by Science Magazine, shows those actions end up releasing huge amounts of carbon dioxide. The study finds that over a 30-year span, biofuels end up contributing twice as much carbon dioxide to the air as the amount of gasoline would when you add in these global effects.
Right now, there's little doubt that ethanol is making global warming worse.
Searchinger's team says these fuels are turning out to be anything but environmentally friendly. Alex Farrell at the University of California, Berkeley, agrees.
I think this paper will have major implications for the use of biofuels around the world.
Here in the United States, the federal government is offering large subsidies to encourage corn-based ethanol. That's a boon to Midwestern farmers and provides a domestic supply of fuel. The Bush administration is calling for a vast expansion of this industry as part of a plan to reduce gasoline consumption by 20%.
If you care about greenhouse gases, then this expansion of the corn biofuel industry is going in the wrong direction.
Farrell says the new study will clearly need to be verified with similar analyses, but he says the overall conclusion looks solid. And it's not just an academic matter. Federal law says future biofuel sources will eventually need to be certified as benefiting the climate. If the new study holds up to scrutiny, America's main industry, corn-based ethanol, would flunk that test.
Well, what is their solution?
Matt Hartwig is a spokesman for the Renewable Fuels Association, a trade group. He says the world needs more energy, and ethanol is filling a need.
I mean, sure, today ethanol production or renewable fuel technology itself is not perfect, but it is evolving and becoming better.
But the new study concludes that even vast efficiency improvements in ethanol production won't change the equation. As long as the starting material is grown on farmland, Searchinger says biofuels will be bad for the planet. But Alex Farrell at Berkeley does see a way out of this. He says the focus of the biofuels industry needs a rapid change of direction, away from using cropland, which is where most U.S. biofuels come from today, and toward other sources of starting material.
We could replace all of the ethanol that we consume in California just using waste that goes to the landfill today and turning that into ethanol.
Environmentally friendly biofuels could also be made from agricultural waste or grasses grown on land that's not suitable for crops. The biofuels industry is heading in that direction, but the technology to make use of fuels other than corn and soy is still in its infancy. Richard Harris, NPR News.